Philippians 3, if you have your Bibles, please turn to Philippians 3. And we left off last week in chapter 3, right in the middle of verse 4. Let's pick back up. Paul goes on and says, "If someone else thinks they have reasons to put confidence in the flesh, I have more. Circumcised on the eighth day, of the people of Israel, of the tribe of Benjamin, a Hebrew of Hebrews. In regard to the Torah, a Pharisee. As for zeal, persecuting the church. As for righteousness based on the Torah, faultless. But whatever were gains to me, I now consider loss for the sake of Messiah. What is more, I consider everything a loss because of the surpassing worth of knowing Messiah Jesus, my Lord, for whose sake I have lost all things. I consider them garbage that I may gain the Messiah and be found in him, not having a righteousness of my own that comes from the Torah, but that which is through faith in the Messiah, the righteousness that comes from God on the basis of faith. I want to know the King of the world. Yes, to know the power of his resurrection and participation in his sufferings, becoming like him in his death, and so somehow attaining to the resurrection from the dead." We left off with Paul warning the Philippians about the dogs, or the Jews in the church who were saying to the Gentiles, "Hey, listen, if you want to follow Jesus, you need to become, in essence, Jewish. You need to get circumcised, for starters, and then you need to keep Torah and keep the dietary laws and not break the Sabbath. You need to become Jewish." And Paul says, "Whoa, no, absolutely not. Philippians, watch out for the dogs who are all upside down." And he says the dogs, and I quote, "put confidence in the flesh," in verse 3. Now that word flesh is sarx in Greek, and right here it means Jewish ethnicity. Hey, watch out for the dogs who put confidence in the fact, hey, I'm Jewish and I'm circumcised. Paul says, listen, me on the other hand, I put confidence in Jesus. But then he says, "But though I myself have reasons for such confidence, if someone else thinks they have reasons to put confidence in the flesh or in kind of Jewish ethnicity, I have more." Meaning, okay, if you want to play the who's more Jewish game, okay, but I forewarn you, I win, right? I'm Paul. And then next, he lays out his Jewish pedigree, and it's kind of sarcastic, kind of tongue-in-cheek, right? He lays out his Jewish pedigree and says, listen, I know better than the Judaizers or the dogs who are saying you need to become Jewish. Now, let's work the text line by line. First off, in 5, Paul says, circumcised on the eighth day. Now, the Torah commanded Jewish parents to circumcise their sons on the eighth day. He's saying, I was born the child of Torah-observant Jews. Then he says, of the people of Israel. Want me to answer that for you? Any? I'm happy to. That would be funny. No? Okay. The word people, I don't know why, the word people is genios. It's where we get the word genealogy. And he's saying, listen, I'm an ethnic Jew. I'm not a proselyte, right? I am the full-on real deal. I'm Jewish to the core. Then he says, of the tribe of Benjamin, the tribe of Israel's first king. In fact, his Jewish name, his Hebrew name is Saul. He's named after Israel's first king. But not only that, by the first century, there were only a few tribes left that could trace their ancestry. Judah, Jesus was from the tribe of Judah, and Benjamin. Paul is saying, listen, I'm one of the few Jews left in Israel who can trace his ancestry all the way back to Abraham. I'm of the tribe of Benjamin. And then he says, a Hebrew of Hebrews. Now that can be translated a Hebrew-speaking child born to Hebrew-speaking parents. Right? By Paul's time, by the first century, there were a whole bunch of different categories of Jews, and the vast majority were Hellenists, Jews who were, in Paul's view, sellouts to Greek culture, who were Hellenized by Alexander the Great a few hundred years before, who spoke Greek and all of that. And Paul says, listen, I'm not me. I'm a Hebraic Jew. I'm a Hebrew of Hebrews. I speak Hebrew. You don't. I speak Hebrew, and I read the Torah every day in the original languages. I'm a Hebrew of Hebrews. And then he says, in regard to the, and my Bible says law, But keep in mind that word law in English is a translation of the Hebrew word Torah, which is the rules and regulations from Moses embedded in the first five books of the Bible, Genesis through Deuteronomy. He says, listen, in regard to the Torah, I was a Pharisee. And you guys know about the Pharisees from the Gospels, right? From kind of the Jesus story. The Pharisees were a sect in first century Israel, and nobody was more serious about the Torah than the Pharisees. Nobody. Right? The Pharisees, we think, believed that if all Israel were to keep the Torah for one day, then the Messiah would come. For obvious reasons, they were OCD about the Torah, right? Paul says, okay, in regard to Torah, I was a Pharisee, right? I mean, I win, right? Then he says, as for zeal, persecuting the church. Now, that word zeal in Greek does not mean passion per se, way more than that. Zeal was a hyper fanatical religious nationalism. What militant Islamic fundamentalism is to Islam, the kind of zealots, which was a political group in Paul's day, were to Judaism, insurgents or terrorists in today's language over against the Roman Empire. And Paul was not a zealot per se, but he was zealous. He was fueled by a religious anger. Nobody is filled with more anger and bitterness and hate and rage than religious people. And he says, listen, I was fueled by a religious anger for the Torah and for Israel to the point I persecuted the church. In his autobiography in Acts, he says, I persecuted the church to the death and I dragged off men and women to prison. I was zealous, he says, for the Torah, for Israel. And then last, he says, as for righteousness based on the Torah, faultless. Now, that word faultless does not mean sinless. It was a technical term used at the temple for after you made a sacrifice, you were blameless, or it can be translated faultless or innocent. Prior to the sacrifice, if you sinned, if you broke Torah, you were guilty. But after you made the sacrifice, you were faultless or you were innocent. Paul's saying, listen, I was a Pharisee. I keep Torah. And on the rare occasion where I screw up, right? On the rare occasion when I break one of the 613 commandments in the Torah, I go straight to the temple. I live in Jerusalem. I go through all the purification rites, the mikvot and the washings, and I make the sacrifices, the bull, this, that, the other. And I, when it comes to the Torah, when it comes to the 613 commandments in Moses, I'm faultless. I'm innocent. In essence, Paul's saying, listen, I win. Right? Circumcised on the eighth day, Hebrew of Hebrews, Pharisee, zealous to the point of I win. He lays all, now in Paul's world, that was an unbeatable resume, right? You don't top that. And Paul lays all of that out on the table. And then notice, look down at your Bibles. Then he says, but seven, whatever were gains to me, I now consider loss for the sake of the Messiah. Now, in Greek, that is an accounting metaphor. Any accountants in the house tonight? No. Okay. Well, one. Serena, holy cow, you own an accounting firm. Yes, right? This sermon was for you, was custom fit for you, right? It's an accounting metaphor of a balance sheet. And on one side, you have your losses. On the other side, you have your gains. That word gains can be translated to my profit. And Paul says, you know, I used to put that list, circumcised on the eighth day of the people of Israel, you know, a Hebrew of Hebrews, all that. I used to put that list in my gains, right? I thought all of that was to my profit. But then I found Jesus. And Jesus turned my world upside down. And I realized, holy cow, my math is all off. And I moved all of that over from my gains to my losses, from my assets to my liabilities, and I put Jesus at the top of my list for to my profit. And then he says, not only that, what is more, I consider everything a loss. Okay, not just the list of, you know, the few things. No, I consider everything. You fill in the blank, doesn't matter. It's all a loss. And that word consider is used twice by Paul, once in verse 7, and in Greek it's in past tense, and then again in verse 8, and it's in present tense. He's saying, listen, years ago, when I first found Jesus on the road to Damascus, if you know that story, I considered all that stuff loss. You know, the fact I was Jewish and I was circumcised and I was a Pharisee, I considered all that. And here I am years later, and you know what? I still consider all that lost. I don't regret that decision for one second. I still, to this day, I consider all that stuff, not only the list, but everything, a loss. And then he says, because of, and that can be translated compared to, the surpassing worth of knowing the Messiah Jesus, my Lord. Like all that stuff, it's loss compared to knowing Jesus, for whose sake I have lost all things. If you know Paul's story, he had to give up so much to follow Jesus. I mean, he was a rising star in first century Israel. He was on the Sanhedrin, which was a hyper elite group of 70 of the most powerful leaders in the Jewish world. He was the protege of Gamaliel, brilliant intellect of his day. He was on track to become the next Rabbi Hillel or Rabbi Shammai. I mean, he's a genius. He lived in Jerusalem. The odds are he was well off, a whole bunch of money, safety, security. He gave all of that up to become what? A dirt poor, wandering, kind of wannabe rabbi who planted churches all over the empire, who's persecuted, who is in prison, who's subject to torture and chronic illness, we think, because of beating after beating after beating. Yeah, I had to give up a bunch, Paul says. But then he says, I have lost all things, and notice, I consider them garbage. Now, that word garbage is skubalon in Greek. Can you say skubalon? Right. Now, skubalon can be translated garbage or, to be honest, excrement. It's a nasty word, right? It's the closest thing we have to an expletive in the New Testament. It's not quite, but I can't really say the English equivalent, or I would get the skubalon beat out of me. But ancient cities, not bad. Ancient cities like Philippi were filthy, dirty. I mean, crazy high population density ratios, people piled on top of people and out in the open. And the sewage system was, in essence, a ditch that ran through the streets and the alleyways of the city, out the dung gate. Every city in the ancient world had a dung gate. Mars Grove had a... Wait, what? Is there a demon on a microphone? No, not... That was not me. I don't take no credit. Anyway... Every city had a dung gate, and the sewage flowed out the dung gate to an area outside the city. Now, that ditch was filled with garbage and trash and muck and urine and human waste with skubalon. And Paul says, all that stuff, I was circumcised, I was a Pharisee, I was in the Sanhedrin, I was at the top of my class, I was a success in the eyes of the world. You know what? Compared to Jesus, compared to knowing the Messiah, Jesus, it's all skubalon. It's all garbage. It's all trash. It's all excrement compared to knowing Jesus. And I would give it all up 1,000 times over. And then he says, that I may gain the Messiah. He's on the accounting metaphor, right? That I may put the Messiah, Jesus, at the top of my list of gains of profit. Right there, Jesus. Now, what does Paul mean by gain the Messiah? Well, Paul lays out four things in the next few verses in 9 to 11, four things that you and I gain when we follow Jesus. And if you're a follower of Jesus, it's stuff that you have in your back pocket, so to speak. If you're not yet a follower of Jesus, it's an open invite to anybody on the planet who is ready to put faith in Jesus and follow God. And here's what you gain. First off, let's read verse 9. And being found in him, not having a righteousness of my own that comes from the Torah, but that which is through faith in the Messiah, the righteousness that comes from God on the basis of faith. Now, there's a whole bunch there. Here we go, short version. First off, you gain a new, and Paul uses that kind of funky word, righteousness. More on that word in a minute. Paul says, listen, I want to be found. And that's in a kind of interesting Greek tense. It means found in the present and in the future. Meaning, I want to be found right here, right now, And in the future, on Judgment Day, when I stand in front of the Creator of the universe, I want to be found or discovered to be, and Paul says, in Him. Now that phrase, in Him, or in Christ, or in the Messiah, is used by Paul upwards of 100 times in his 14 letters in the New Testament. And it's a word used all over theology. The technical word is union in theology, or incorporation, or if you're from kind of the Eastern Church, it's participation in the divine. And the idea, in a nutshell, is that when you start to follow Jesus, when you are baptized, that's step one, right, to Jesus. When you are baptized, you are, and Paul says in his letter to the Romans, chapter 6, go read, you are baptized into the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus. Paul says in Romans 6, you are buried with Jesus in the waters of baptism and resurrection. You come back up out of the waters. And in that moment, you are united with Jesus, union. You are incorporated into Jesus, incorporation. You become in Jesus. You ask why I love baptism. What a metaphor, right? Your life is swallowed up. You are drowned by, you are swimming in the waters that are the Messiah, Jesus. I love what Paul says in his letter to the Colossians. He says, you died at baptism. You died, and your life is now hidden with Christ in God. You are in Jesus. For example, here I stole from my boy Jude. Here's Master Yoda. Who doesn't love Master Yoda, right? Happy to be here, I am. Here's my water, all right? I forewarn you, on the scale of lame to awesome, this is on the lame side, but... All right, Yoda is in the glass, right? Now, when you see the glass, you see who? Yoda. And when you see Yoda, you see what? The glass. You can't look at Yoda without seeing the glass, and you can't look at the glass without seeing Yoda, because Yoda is in the what? Glass. In the same way, you are in Jesus. You were baptized into the waters. That was so dumb. You are so, why homeschooled? yeah, therapy is a waste of money. You were baptized into the waters of Jesus. You're swallowed up. You are in Jesus. And now when God, the Creator, looks at you, He sees Jesus. And the reciprocal is also true. When God looks at Jesus, He sees you because you are in Jesus. And that's not just in, and please listen, an individualistic sense. Hey, I'm in Jesus. But Paul says in the Messiah. Now, stay with me for 30 seconds. The Messiah, which is one of a few ways to translate the Greek word Christos. It can be translated Christ, or I far prefer the Messiah, or the King of the world, right? And the Messiah was Israel's representative. Or put another way, the Messiah was Israel in person. In Israel's identity devolved onto the shoulders of one man, Jesus, the rabbi and the Messiah from Nazareth. Meaning what? Meaning when you are baptized into the Messiah Jesus, at the same time you are baptized into Israel. Not Israel in the sense of ethnic Jews, the majority of you are not, but baptized into Israel in the sense of the family of God or the people of God all around the world. In the same way that when I adopted my daughter Sunday, in one moment she became my daughter. And at the same time, she became a Comer. She became Jude and Moses' sister and Pops' granddaughter and Duke's cousin. She is now in my family. In the same way, when you are baptized into Jesus, you are in Him. And that means you are now in the family of God. The Creator of the universe is now your Father. You used to be an enemy of God. You may not think of yourself that way, but all humans on the planet were created in the image of God, have been broken by sin, and stand as an enemy of the living God prior to faith in Jesus. But through faith, when God saved you, when you were baptized into Jesus, you move from an enemy of God to a child of God. And now the Father looks at you. And don't get me wrong, He sees all of your flaws and baggage and problems and issues, but He loves you to pieces. In the same way that I look at my three kids and I see all of the dysfunction and problems and issues they inherited from their mother, and I... Just kidding. Love you, babe. All two flaws and the 395 from me, right? I see all the baggage, all the flaws, all the issues, and in spite of that, I'm head over heels in love with my kids. In the same way, God, he's not stupid. He's not blind. John, he knows you're a tool shed at times, right? No offense. I mean, I think you're great, but God knows you better than me, right? He knows all your weaknesses, and he sees all your weaknesses, and he disciplines you as a father. He doesn't turn a blind eye, but he loves you to pieces. He disciplines you, in fact, because he loves you. Same is true for every man and woman here who follows Jesus. You are in the Messiah. That means you are in the family of God. That means when God looks at you, he sees you as a son or as a daughter. And Paul says, listen, I want to be found now and in the future in the Messiah. And then he goes on to say, not having a righteousness of my own that comes from the Torah. Now, that word righteousness is funky because it's not used much, not back, it's not used much outside of the church. And when it is, it's in a negative way, right? He's self-righteous or she's self-righteous, or in a 90s surfer Bill and Ted kind of way, right? Fans, anybody? No? Yeah, okay. But in the scriptures, it's not a moral word per se. I think of righteousness as a moral word. You know, if he or she is righteous, or if he is self-righteous, that means he thinks he's better than everybody, right? But in the scriptures, it's not a moral word per se. It's a legal word. It was a word used as a technical word used in a Hebrew law court from Paul's day. You would stand in front of a judge. Right? There was no jury in a Hebrew law court. There was a righteous, you hope, judge and two opponents in court. You would stand shoulder to shoulder with your opponent in front of the judge, and he would justify one of you, meaning he would declare one of you to be righteous. And that word righteous was a technical word, and in Paul's day, it means in the right. He would look at one of you and say, you're righteous. You are in the right in the eyes of the court. Paul says, listen, one day, I know that I'm going to stand along with billions of other humans. I'm going to stand in front of the creator of the universe at judgment day. And I don't want to stand in front of the judge of the universe and say, oh, hello, God, I'm Jewish. And I'm circumcised, woo-hoo. And I keep the Torah, and I don't break the commandments, and I keep the Sabbath. Nothing wrong with any of that. But Paul says, listen, I don't want a righteousness or a right standing that is based on the Torah. Rather, he goes on and he says, but that which is through faith in the Messiah, the righteousness that comes from God on the basis of faith. Paul says, I want to stand in front of God and say, listen, I'm with him. Jesus, right? I'm with him. I don't want a righteousness or right based on, I'm Jewish and I'm... No, I'm with him. A righteousness that is by faith in the Messiah. Now, you should know that word faith is pistis in Greek. And a few hundred years ago when the scriptures were first being translated into English, one of the long... running debates all over Western Europe and schools and all over the world was how to translate that Greek word pistis into English. And there were two options, faith or faithfulness. And Luther and Calvin and all the guys from a few hundred years back and forth, should we say faith or should we say faithfulness? Because it sounds a bit different, am I right? Right? What if I were to say, hey, you're saved by grace through faithfulness? Wow, that sounds quite a bit different than faith. And it's hard because there's no such thing as a word-for-word translation of the Bible, and language doesn't work that way, right? How do you take pistis and that idea and make that an English word? And the Reformers landed on faith, and that may or may not have been the right decision. It's way over my pay grade, right? But here's what I know in the wake of that decision. I know that the downside to opting for faith rather than faithfulness is that the vast majority of people inside the church, not to mention outside the church, think that faith is a synonym to belief, and it's not. Faith and belief are not the exact same thing. Faith in the Messiah is not the same thing as belief in the Messiah. You know, don't get me wrong, belief is a part of faith, There's so much more. One scholar I read a few days ago defined faith as belief plus loyalty. Pistis, as faith as belief plus loyalty. Meaning you believe in Jesus. You believe he's the crucified Messiah, not only of Israel, but of the world. But on top of that, you believe he is the Lord of the universe. He is Yahweh, the creator in flesh and blood. You believe. Yeah, you have your doubts at times, but you believe. But it's more than belief. It's belief plus loyalty, plus faithfulness. You trust in Jesus. You lean your weight onto Jesus. You take Jesus by the hand and you walk faithfully with your God day in, day out, year after year, decade after decade. Belief plus loyalty. You hang on and you don't let go. And one day you make it all the way to resurrection and judgment, and you, with Jesus' hand in yours, stand in front of God and say, I'm with him. Not because I'm circumcised or I'm Jewish or I keep Torah. I'm with because of faith, because I hang on to him. And I'm swallowed up in him. And I'm your son. I'm your daughter. And I have faith, belief plus loyalty in the Messiah, Jesus. Paul says, listen, when you start to follow Jesus, you gain a brand spanking new kind of righteousness. You are right in the eyes of God. You're no longer an enemy of God. You are a son or a daughter. You are in the Messiah by faith. Not because you're Jewish or you keep this law or you keep that law or you go to, but by faith in the living God, Jesus. Now, secondly, Paul goes on. Look down at your scriptures. Paul goes on and says in 10, secondly, I want to know the Messiah. Yes, to know the power of his resurrection and participation in his sufferings. Secondly, you gain a new knowledge, for lack of a better word. Now, that word know or knowledge is gnosko in Greek. And it's a word used of when a man knows a woman on his wedding night. It's a word of intimacy. It's not just a cerebral head knowledge, and Paul is not at all down on head knowledge. Right? He's sharp as a tack. He writes the Bible for a living. Okay, he's a full-on theologue, right? But he says, listen, that's not enough just to cerebral head knowledge about God. No, I want to know the Messiah. It's the exact same word he uses in verse 7 when he says the surpassing worth of knowing the Messiah Jesus. And then notice he says, my Lord. That is the one and only spot in all of the New Testament, all of Paul's letters, that he says, my Lord. And think back to chapter 2, verse 11, when Paul quotes from Isaiah, an epic text about the creator God, Yahweh. And he says, Jesus the Messiah is Kyrios in Greek, or Lord in English, which is how you translate the Hebrew word Yahweh, the proper name for God. He's saying Jesus, the Messiah of Israel, is Yahweh in flesh and blood, in black and white, in your face, straight up language. And then in chapter 3, he says, oh yeah, and he's my Yahweh in flesh and blood. He's my God. And I want to know not just about God, but I want to know God in and through Jesus. And make sure you get the difference, right? You can know about somebody without knowing somebody. It's called stalking them, right? No, seriously. I mean, for example, I know all about President Obama, right? He's the most powerful man in the world. He's in the news every day. His autobiography on Shell. He's fascinating to me. I know people who know President Obama. I know a guy, a friend of mine, who works for the administration. I was with him a few weeks ago, and he lives in D.C., works at the White House, and he plays basketball with the president every single week. And he was telling me hilarious stories about how, Robbie, you would love this, how he was really nervous at first to play, because I guess the president's quite a baller, right? I guess he's pretty rough on the court. And he said, I don't know. I mean, like, do you push back? I mean, he's the president of the United States, right? I mean, what happens if you, like, elbow him and he shows up for a press conference with a black eye and that was you, right? Why were you fired? Well, And then on top of that, the Secret Service agents are right on the edge of the court glaring at you, you know? I know people who know the president, but I don't know the president from Adam. Right? We're not friends. Right? He doesn't text me at night, hey buddy, what's up, JMC, you know? Right? I mean, no, it doesn't happen. I know all about him, but I don't know him. In the same way, so many people know all about God, but don't know God. Jesus changed all that for every man and every woman who wants to know God. There is now a one-way ticket, and it goes by the name Jesus. Because Jesus, to be honest, is not a ticket to God. He is God. And he shows up on your doorstep, knocks on your front door, and says, I'm here, I'm ready. If you want to know God, follow me. And you can, when you gain Jesus, you can know God. Do you understand the gravity of that reality? You can know God. I hope and pray you take full advantage of the fact that the Spirit of the living God lives where? Right inside you. 24/7, 365. It is hands down my favorite thing about following Jesus. What is? Jesus. And the fact that I get to know Jesus in intimacy, in a gnosko kind of way. The way I know my wife and she knows me. All my junk and flaws and all my successes and all my failures and all my quirks. She knows me inside and out. In the same way, I get to know, I get to gnosko God in Jesus. I get to wake up in the morning. Guess what happens? God speaks to me. How crazy is that? God spoke to me this morning. I was down and discouraged. He spoke to me this afternoon. And I was, because I get to know God. Take full advantage, my friends, of the fact the Spirit of God is in you 24/7. You drive in the road or on your, wherever he is with you. He's God, he's close by. And when you start to follow Jesus, you gain a brand new knowledge. Then third, Paul goes on, he says, listen, I want to know Christ, I want to know the Messiah, and then he says, yes, to know the power of his resurrection. Meaning, I want the exact same power that raised Jesus from the dead is at work in me. I want to tap into that power. And then he says, and notice, participation in his sufferings. That word participation is koinonia. It's that word used by Paul all over Philippians. It means partnership. I want to partner with Jesus in what? In his sufferings? Yes. Becoming like him in his what? Death. Now, if I'm a Philippian, and I'm there, and, you know, Philippians is, you know, read out loud. Okay, I want to know Jesus. Yep, I'm with you. The power of his resurrection. Oh, yeah, heck yeah, count me in. And partnership in his sufferings, becoming like him in his death. No, I'm okay, thanks. Right? I'll stick with Jesus and resurrection. Let's skip the cross part, the suffering part. The problem is that resurrection comes on the other side of the cross. Glory comes on the other side of suffering. And make sure you get what Paul says. He says, listen, I want to know Jesus. How? Well, I want to tap into the power of the resurrection. I want the living God to work in and through me. And I want to partner with Jesus in his suffering. Why in the world? Are you out of your mind? Because when that happens, I become, and Paul says, like him in his death. Now that phrase, becoming like him in his death, can be translated being continually conformed. Notice the language, conformed to his death. It's from the Greek word morphe, that means form. Or it can be translated a form and pattern of his death. When you gain Jesus, you get a whole new form and pattern to live by. Think of, anybody here in construction? No, one of you. Okay, well done. Think of concrete forms, right? You all, I mean, you live in America, right? Think of a foundation of a house or of a building on the side of the road or a retaining wall, right? Before the concrete is poured, it starts off with a form. Dudes like you, right? You make forms. You take plywood or man stuff, I don't know, whatever. You take wood, and you make a form in the shape that you want the foundation to be in, or the fire pit to be in, or the wall to be in. And then you pour the concrete into the forms, and over time it hardens. And when it's ready, you take away the wood, you take away the forms, and lo and behold, the concrete is in the exact same shape as the forms. Paul is saying, listen, Jesus' life, but not only that, his death, his suffering on the cross, and his glory in the resurrection. Well, that That is the form and pattern that you are to live by. That is the form that you are to pour your life into. And what happens is over time, in particular through suffering, your who you are gets set in stone through suffering. And in time, God takes away the forms, takes away the plywood, and wow, lo and behold, it's crazy how much you look like Jesus. It's crazy. Well, that's the shape of Jesus, and that's the shape of you, and wow, that's, I mean, not quite, but really close. You start to take on a whole new form, a whole new way to live. You need to understand that God's heart for you is not just to be in Jesus, but is to be like Jesus. And that happens more than anything in times of suffering. I always feel stupid talking about suffering because compared to so many of you, I have not suffered. But I'm human. I live on planet Earth. I'm not immune. And I have found in my life, and my guess is I'm not alone, that in the good times, when all is fine and dandy, right, and it's sunny outside all 3 days of the year, right, that to be honest, my walk with Jesus, I mean, it's all fine, but it's flat. It's prosaic. It's tepid. It's, yeah, I pray and I read the scriptures and I walk with Jesus, blah, blah, blah. But I'm happy. I'm happy. But in the rough patches, and in particular, if there's anything close to a sliver of the kind of suffering that Jesus knows about, of being rejected in the way that Jesus rejected, or being tired in the way that Jesus was tired, or being worn out in the way that Jesus, if there's a sliver, anything comes close to the kind of suffering that Jesus knows all of, I have found that I grow like a weed. That I'm on the edge of my seat, I'm hungry, and I'm thirsty for God. I'm in the scriptures all the time, I'm in prayer, I'm in God's presence, God speaks over me, and I find that my character grows like crazy. It's that suffering is an incubator for growth. Paul's sharp, he gets that better than anybody. He says, you know what? It's in times of sufferings, when I partner with Jesus in his suffering, when I'm rejected like Jesus was rejected, when I, and this I think is going to happen, when I die, the hands of the empire in the same way that Jesus died, you know what? I become more and more like Jesus. My life is poured into the form of Jesus. I take on the Messiah-shaped life, the dying and rising-shaped life. I take on the form and the pattern of Jesus. That is what you gain in Jesus. And that may not sound like it should go in the gains column. That may sound like it should go in the losses column, but Paul says, no, no, trust me. Even if it means suffering, even if it means, trust me, it's gain. It's to my profit to become like Jesus, becoming like him in his death. And then last he says, and here's why, okay, here's how he's filled with that hope. Lastly, he says, and so somehow, 11, attaining to the resurrection from the dead. Somehow, I don't know how, I don't know if I'm going to die of old age, that's not likely. Or if I'm going to die right here in prison as an enemy of the state, I don't know. But either way, my horizon is filled with the hope of resurrection. Right? Somehow, I don't know, but attaining to the resurrection from the dead. Now keep in mind, resurrection does not mean going to heaven when you die, okay? Resurrection is what happens after heaven. It's at the climactic point in human history, at the return of Jesus, the King of the world, your soul returns from the heavens or a God space, your body comes up out of the ground, and in a miraculous cosmic act of new creation, resurrection. You are recreated in the image of God, and your body is set free from all sickness and in the end, death. No more achy bones, no more, my lower back hurts from cycling yesterday. None of that, right? It's all over and done with. And your soul is set free from any and all sin. No more lust, no more greed, no more discontentment, no more anger. None. It's all. You have the innocence of a child and the wisdom of old age. You in a resurrection existence, rule and reign over the earth, and you live forever, all that in God's presence. That is what is waiting for all of you who follow Jesus. Did you hear that? That is what is waiting for. How many of you follow Jesus? Yeah, that's your long-term plan right there. What are your goals for life? Resurrection. I'm a 10 cities kind of guy. It's a Jesus parable thing. I'm sorry. Inside joke, right? Resurrection, ruling, reigning, no more sin. Oh, boom. It's in the 3 million year plan. It's fabulous, right? That, seriously. I mean, it sounds crazy. No, if it sounds too good to be true, Yeah. That's in this life. That's not in the life to come. That is the real, true future of all of you who follow Jesus. You are in the Messiah. And what happened to Jesus, death followed by burial, followed by what? Resurrection. One day will happen to all of you who follow Jesus. And after that, to the whole cosmos, death, burial, and resurrection. That is your future waiting for you. It's in store at the end of the road, which, to be honest, is a new beginning. Make sure your horizon is filled up with that hope. Make sure you remember that when you wake up in a few weeks and go to Math 65 at PCC. Make sure you remember that when you wake up tomorrow morning and go to your job that... Make sure you remember that when your marriage is broken. Make sure you remember that when it's 6 months of chemo. Make sure you remember that when he walks out. Make sure you remember that when you are rejected. Make sure you remember, listen, this is not the end of the story. The end of the story is an empty tomb and a brand new creation and a living God right in front of me. That, my friends, is what you gain when you follow Jesus. All of that. And that's how Paul can say, listen, all that stuff, yeah, I was a Pharisee. Yeah, I was on the Sanhedrin. Yeah, I was a bunch of money. Okay, whatever. But it's all scubalon compared to Jesus. Right? It's all, a new righteousness, a new right standing. I'm in the family of God. I'm a son, I'm a daughter, a new knowledge. I get to know, I get to wake up in the morning and know God and walk with God, a new form to live by, a new way to be human, and a new future to wake up and think about day. Oh, yeah, absolutely. I consider all of that loss. I would not trade one day for Jesus. But notice what Paul says. Listen, Jesus is free, but at the same time, it costs you everything to follow Jesus. Am I right? You know, notice Paul's polemic, right? Paul's kind of how he thinks, right? He's saying, listen, here's what I had to give up to follow Jesus. Hint, hint. What do you need to give up to follow Jesus? Now, for the Philippians, it's not the exact same list. The Philippians aren't Jews and aren't circumcised and aren't Pharisees. Paul's saying, okay, Philippians, here's my list. Here's what I had to give up. What about you? What do you need to give up to follow Jesus? Portlanders, what do you need to give up to follow Jesus? My guess is, you know, you're not going to put circumcision on the list. I mean, if you want, okay. But what's on your list? What if you tonight, as we step into worship, what if you were to pray, Spirit of Jesus, the Messiah and the King, what do I need to give up to follow you? If you have the courage to pray that, I promise you that God will speak. Trust me. I know what God spoke over me a few days ago and all day long today. What do I need to give up to follow Jesus? Now, to end, my favorite story, I think, that Jesus tells is in Matthew's gospel. And it's a story about a man who's walking through a field and he finds buried treasure right in the middle of the field. In the ancient world, there were no banks, no IRAs. And if you had money, you would bury your fortune in the ground under a tree or what have you. But if you died, and that was likely, I mean, life expectancy was low in the ancient world, and nobody claimed the fortune, okay, it was public domain. And there's a dude walking through a field and he trips or whatever and he stumbles upon buried treasure. And Jesus says he goes all the way home and he sells everything he has. Can you imagine selling everything you have? If you're in college, that whole box plus your iPhone and your $400 jeans, all of that. I mean, selling everything he has and he saves up every last penny and he goes and he buys the field. and in doing so, he gets the treasure. Jesus says, listen, that's what it's like to follow me. Yes, it costs you life. Yes, it costs you so much. And yes, you have to give up this and that and the other. For the majority of you, it's not literally selling everything you own. Maybe. But there's a list, right? Jesus says, yeah, but you know what? You get the treasure. And here's what you have to understand. He is the treasure. Am I right? Jesus is the treasure. And trust me, he's worth it. Would you agree? Yeah. Let's pray.